You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up last Saturday, Garrison Keillor wrapped up his 42 years as the host of A Prairie Home Companion. We'll ask you to share your favorite memories, segments, and guests.
First, Republican Congressman Reed Ribble has been representing Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District for 6 years. He'll leave Congress after this term, though, having decided not to seek re-election.
Despite his plans to leave Congress, Ribble hopes to continue working on bipartisan issues and efforts, specifically, naming Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin's 2nd District as a friend and ally.
Reed Ribble joins us now to talk about his plans and the future of the GOP. Congressman Ribble, thanks for taking time to speak with us today.
I'm happy to be with you. Thank you, Judith.
You've been representing Wisconsin's 8th District for 6 years now. How would you describe the atmosphere in Washington and specifically in Congress during that time?
Well, it just depends on what the issue is. I think if you follow the news every single day, you see places where things are relatively routine and mundane here in Washington, and then other times where the political differences between left and right show up real dramatically. And so it just depends on the individual circumstances of the day and what is happening in and around us here in D.C. That will either make it a little more mundane and normal or whether it makes it a little more fractured. Maybe that's a better word to use.
Certainly during this election cycle, things seem very polarized. Would you say that that's an accurate representation? Has it gotten worse on that particular angle?
You know, my observation has been that the second year of every session, and Congress is in session for 2 years running, the second year is always the more difficult one because we get into a period of time where not only are members a little bit more fearful about their reelections, and so they're more cautious about what they want to work on, but we also see the political divide widen. Political campaigns and the political campaign season happens every 2 years are always about the differences, whereas governing is always about what's in common. And so during the times where members are actually campaigning and running for reelection or new members are running for election, the differences come out and they become much more stark. And it's the normal process of the political campaign season that we enter so regularly.
And so as those members of Congress are having to posture and present themselves with the hopes of appealing to their constituents for re-election, how does that affect the ability of you and other members of Congress to move forward legislation?
It makes it much more difficult, particularly if you're trying to do larger scale things. And so I think what we're seeing this year here in Congress is that although things are getting done, they're not addressing the big issues of the day, whether it's reforming and protecting Social Security and Medicare, dealing with tax reform or the regulatory environment. I think that the discussion might get centered on there, but the legislation doesn't go anywhere, or even legislation may not be offered on those things. They just become talking points, and then you begin to see a diversity of ideas and opinions happen, and the polarity kind of settle in.
Well, and as you said, members of Congress are having to come up for re-election every 2 years, whereas senators have 6 years. Do you think that makes it especially challenging for the members of the House where you are?
It sure it does, because you're always coming back. And it's been my observation that a member of the House of Representatives, and probably this is true for members of the Senate as well, you're always the most courageous the day right after your election, and you're the most fearful the day before. Mm. And at some point during that two-year period, many members of Congress move away from a posture of governing from courage to a posture of governing from fear. And it's at that point that things start to grind to a halt because nobody wants to take any risk.
You have prioritized building relationships across the aisle in your time in Congress, especially in what is a pretty polarized period. Why did you decide to make that a priority for yourself?
Because I really believe that our founders set up a system 200 years ago, 200 plus years ago, that was centered around this core idea. They basically told leaders of this country, where you can find agreement, do those things. If you cannot find agreement, go back to the drawing board until you can. And what I've discovered in my very short time here is that the reason we don't often get agreement is because not enough members of Congress are actually looking for it. They're not seeking out avenues. They're not learning about each other and about why these political differences exist in our national lexicon. And so I wanted to get out and spend more time with some Democrat colleagues so I could not just learn about them and their families, but also learn about the why. Why do they hold this view when I have always held an opposing or opposite view? And once you do that and you start to have conversations that are now based on a better relationship, people are willing to open up, and you start to find where those creases are that you can step into, that there's agreement. And that's how I have chosen to manage my time here in Washington.
And so what are those creases? What are those kinds of issues that you're able to find common ground with Democratic colleagues?
Yeah, I'll give you an example that's actually coming to the floor just today. This afternoon, at some point, we're going to be having a vote on the Interior Appropriations Bill. And in that bill is language that I was able to get inserted in bipartisan fashion that would protect the Endangered Species Act from a court that would want to usurp itself into the act and dismantle it. And this is a provision related to the wolf population in northern Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and Wyoming. And the Republican and Democrat members of those states have come together in bipartisan fashion to work on language to reinstate the Endangered Species Act and provide for it as the premier and superior science in relation to how we manage fish and wildlife in this country.
And in reaching across the aisle, who have you found to be the most receptive over there?
Well, I found a lot of friends right in Wisconsin. Both I've spent most of my time with both Ron Kind and Mark Pocan. I do have a great relationship with Gwen Moore as well. And when we have to do things for the state of Wisconsin, I've been very pleased and impressed with how our bicameral, bipartisan delegation has been willing to work together and lock arms to represent Wisconsin in a way that's necessary for a small population state like ours to be effective here in Congress. Other friends of mine in the House of Representatives would be folks like Kurt Schrader from Oregon, Jim Cooper from Tennessee, Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona. I've had an opportunity to spend time last night, Congressman Dan Lipinski from Illinois, another Democrat member, and I went out to dinner together. We had late votes that were going to take place at about 10 o'clock last night. So we broke away at around 6:30, and we had dinner together.
And do you feel like other members of your caucus appreciate your efforts, or have you felt at all discouraged from working with Democrats?
No, I've never once been discouraged from working with members from across the aisle. Both Speaker Boehner and Speaker Ryan have made it clear that legislation that is bipartisan has your best opportunity to become law, and they've encouraged us to find places where we could work together.
You are leaving Congress after this term. Do you think you'll have opportunities to continue working for bipartisanship and on the issues that you care about?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm certain to some degree I'll always weigh in with now the many friends that I have here in Congress. My plan is to go back to my roots in the roofing industry and go back into the private sector as I promised the folks I would when I first ran for office. But I have made many friends here, and I see myself staying in contact with some of them.
Many of your colleagues who leave Congress turn around to become lobbyists. Is that something that you've ever been tempted by?
Not even interested in it.
And
that doesn't mean I wouldn't work for a trade association, because I spent 20 years as a board of director in the National Roofing Contractors Association, but I wouldn't have any interest in the lobbying side of it. I've had my 6 years here in Washington, D.C. I'd like to spend the next 6 years of my life in Wisconsin.
Do you think there's an inherent problem in former legislators turning around and lobbying their former colleagues?
You know, that has not been my experience. I think in my time here in 6 years, I have maybe had just two or three former members of Congress. Sometimes I didn't even know they were former members of Congress reach out to me that are working with some lobbying organization. However, I do recognize that small businesses often will pool themselves together, their resources together, like members of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. They will pool their resources together and hire somebody to represent their interests in Washington, D.C., and they will seek out the person that they believe is best able to reach out to members. But I've never really had a problem with former members contacting me. That, matter of fact, I would say that is extremely rare as opposed to the other.
We're talking with Republican Congressman Reed Ribble, who represents Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. Congressman Ribble, let's turn to the race for the White House. It's looking likely that Donald Trump will come out of the Cleveland Convention later this month as the GOP's presidential nominee. For you, does he represent your party and its principles?
I don't think so, but I've been pretty clear of my disappointment with both of our presidential nominees on both sides of the aisle. I think both of them are flawed candidates, and I'm disappointed as just an American citizen that these are the best candidates that the parties felt that they could offer to the American people. And I think Democrats have been somewhat disappointed with the process that they had, and I know Republicans, including myself, have been disappointed with ours. And but I do believe that Mr. Trump will be the nominee coming out of the Republican convention. He did win that the delegates in a fair, delivered primary process, and he shouldn't be usurped at the convention.
So you don't think he should be usurped, but do you think it's possible that a different candidate could emerge at the convention?
Well, I think that political parties choose their nominees, and the delegates will have the responsibility of following the rules of the convention at the convention to select the nominee. But I don't know that you could come out of that convention with somebody other than Mr. Trump and have any hope of winning in the fall.
And if he is, in fact, the Republican nominee, will you endorse his candidacy?
No, I will not.
And what do you think the impact on the Republican Party will be if he is the nominee, whether or not he wins in November?
Well, you know, I think there's two scenarios there that happen is... one scenario would be that he is victorious in the fall. I don't think that that's going to be the case personally. But if he is, then it will all come down to how he governs over the next 4 years, and that will determine the impact on the party itself. However, I think his rhetoric has already had a damaging impact on the party. His rhetoric about women, his mocking of a disabled person, his language about... Hispanic immigrants. Now, those things are not particularly helpful, and I think that it's damaged the Republican Party, and it will take a long time for them to recover from it.
Well, Congressman Ribble, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Judith, it's been good to be with you. Thank you.
Republican Congressman Reed Ribble represents Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. He's not seeking re-election this November.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, two black men were shot in the last 2 days by police. Both were captured on video by bystanders and have gone viral. We talk about how technology is impacting the way people react to the recent police-involved shootings of Louisiana and Minnesota.
But first, a watershed moment in public radio happened last Saturday night.
If you're one of the faithful, chances are that you know that theme music by heart. But as of last Saturday, the man who is the voice and heart of A Prairie Home Companion has stepped away from the mic.
A Prairie Home Companion first launched in 1974, and it's become a staple of American culture, not to mention the public radio landscape. There was Tales from Lake Wobegon, those ads for Powder Milk Biscuits, Dusty and Lefty and Guy Noir. Well, they've all become as familiar as friends to people who love the show, and there are lots of people who love the show.
A Prairie Home Companion will continue in a revamped format starting in the fall with a new host, regular Prairie Home musical performer Chris Thiele. But right now we want to hear from you. Was A Prairie Home Companion with Garrison Keillor part of your life? Did you listen all the way till the end of the show last Saturday? What was your favorite part of the program, and what are you looking for from the new show? Will you keep listening? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or let us know what you're thinking on the Central Time Facebook page.
If you caught that last show, you know that Garrison Keillor was in good company. He even took a special caller.
You know, hearing about what was going on in Minnesota, and hearing about the latest episodes of Dusty and Lefty and Guy Noir, it made me feel better, and it made me feel more human. And I think a lot of people feel that way.
Made me feel better and made me feel more human, according to President Obama. And, you know, I think that's a really good way to sum up the feeling of a Prairie Home Companion and feeling part of that community.
Yeah, and it really was. There was a comfort factor, too, when I listened to it. Well, let's get to our callers at 800-642-1234. You can let us know about your favorite parts of the show. If you were a fan, what did you love and what are you going to miss? Judy is first in Oshkosh. Judy, hi.
Hi.
What did you like about the show?
One of my very favorite parts of Garrison's show was the way he incorporated old traditional hymns and gospel into his program and had guests that would sing those songs and how he loved to sing along with them.
So you like the sing-alongs. Yeah, that was an interesting
part
of it.
The old traditional hymns, yes,
yeah.
where he himself would sing along with the and harmonize with the entertainer.
Judy, thanks a lot for that. I appreciate that. So those old traditional hymns for her.
And Judy, do you plan to keep listening?
Yes, I do.
All right. Well, we'll want to hear what you think.
Well, thanks a lot for that, Judy, as we celebrate Prairie Home Companion, which had its last show on Saturday night. And we'll go next to Steve joining us in Danbury. Steve, hi.
Hi. I'll definitely miss Garrison. I'll continue to listen to the show, but I think we won't realize just what a huge talent he was until some time has passed here. We had the opportunity to see the show live several times, and that's where you see his true genius at work. I think specifically of the news from Lake Wobegon, which he doesn't read, and if you haven't seen it live, you don't know that. He, most of the time when he did that monologue, he would just stand with his eyes closed or looking at his feet and spin these incredible tales with a huge cast of characters, and I just marveled at his genius every time we went to the show. There were so many disparate elements that he put together into a coherent whole every week, and somehow the whole thing always worked, so I will miss him a lot.
Steve, so glad you brought that up. Judith and I were just talking about that. Neither of us have ever seen the show live, but you're not the only person who said to us this is the place, the live show, where you really felt the genius that Garrison Keillor was. So I can't imagine. He delivered all those monologues without notes.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Well, you're lucky to have seen it, Steve, and we are jealous that we didn't get to. You know, I think one of the geniuses of Garrison Keillor was being able to gently poke fun at people, but it was always so genuine that no one took offense. We would like you to join in and tell us what you like about A Prairie Home Companion, about Garrison Keillor as a storyteller, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Will you miss the show? What were your favorite segments? And will you continue listening now that it'll be a different format? Again, 800-642-1234.
And here's one of the staples of the show throughout the years. Have you tried these?
First portion of our show brought to you by Powder Milk Biscuits in the big blue box with a picture of the biscuit on the cover. Made from whole wheat, raised by Norwegian bachelor farmers, so you know they're not only good for you, they're also pure mostly. Give shy persons strength to get up and do what needs to be done. Heavens, they're tasty and expeditious.
Yeah, there for Powder Milk Biscuits.
A little
That's
bit
classic.
Of an earworm there. I'm sure we'll all be humming that. You know, I have to say I liked a lot of the storytelling elements, but my favorite, I think, was Dusty and Lefty.
The
big butte jeans, the full figure jeans with room in the seat, and by Jim's Used Shoes. If you like pre-faded jeans, you'll love Used Shoes. And now, today's exciting Western adventure.
Yep, come on, yeah. Well, here we are, back in Yellow Gulch.
Yes, sir.
There we go, Dusty and Lefty, and we're going to go back to our callers. We've got Joanne joining us next from Duluth. Joanne, hi.
Hello. Good to talk to you.
You too. What did you want to share?
I just wanted to share, even though I loved everything about the show, and I really appreciated what Steve said about seeing it live, because that was just awesome. But my favorite part was the annual joke show.
Ah, yeah.
I would drive my friends crazy the next day telling the jokes.
Do you have a favorite joke from the show that you remember?
Oh, I don't remember any offhand. I just love that part.
Great. Well, Joanne, thanks a lot for that. A lot of people really like those joke shows.
Yeah, and let's go back to the phones and Charles in Madison. Hi, Charles.
Yeah, hi. What I'm going to miss about it is how the show seemed to bring together my 80-year-old mom and her siblings that bridging distance. They all listen to it, Cleveland, Madison, Pasadena, California, and then during the following week, they would have their weekly calls, and they'd all be laughing about what they heard on the Furry Home Companion.
Well, thanks so much for that, Charles. And I think there was something for everyone, really, in a Prairie Home Companion.
There was. Well, it'll be interesting to see the next iteration. We did an interview with Chris Thiele, the next host, and it's going to be revamped. It's still going to be a Prairie Home Companion. More music, though, and not the whole Garrison Keillor part of it. But we've had a good run.
Well, thanks for all the calls. And remember, you can keep the conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The next time I'm in town.
Now the faces and the places
range across the bridge of time and change. Once again, I'm homeward bound.
There's one thing I promise you,
and that's another rendezvous. The next time I'm in town.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's the Moth Radio Hour. Tonight, a call to a hotline, a rabbi caught speeding, and an obsession with flamenco. That's all tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, from the Midwest to the Deep South, communities and families are mourning the deaths of two black men who were shot by police this week. 37-year-old Alton Sterling was shot on Tuesday morning in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and yesterday evening, Philando Castile was shot dead by a police officer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota.
In Baton Rouge, Sterling was shot outside of a convenience store where he was selling CDs. Police came to the scene after reports of a man carrying a gun threatening others. The owner of the store said he was a friend of Sterling's. In a CNN interview, he alleged that Sterling was shot 6 times, even though Sterling did not attempt to reach for his firearm.
First, they shot 3 times while they were still on top of him. And they jumped off of him and screamed at him, "Get on the ground," which he was already on the ground and shot at the time. And then they released another 3 shots at him.
And outside Minneapolis, where Philando Castile was shot, Castile was pulled over with his fiancée, Diamond Reynolds, in the passenger seat and her 4-year-old daughter in the back. In a Facebook Live video, Castile's fiancée narrated that they had been pulled over for a broken taillight. According to the video, Castile told the officers he was armed and had a concealed carry permit, but that he was reaching for his wallet to get his license and registration.
Here's a clip from the video after Castile was shot by the officer. The next 28 seconds of audio have sensitive content and may be disturbing for some listeners.
He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand open.
Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone. Please don't tell me that he's gone. Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him. You shot 4 bullets into him, sir. He was just getting his license and registration, sir.
There's been public outcry across the country as the videos of both Sterling and Castile have circulated the internet. And it's not the first time that we've seen social media and technology being used to draw attention to police use of force and police-involved shootings. Joining us now is Ethan Zuckerman. He's director at the Center for Civic Media at MIT and associate professor of the practice in media arts and sciences. Ethan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, and sorry it's on such a horrific topic.
Well, we're glad to have you with us. What's behind this growing trend, would you say, of using social media and technology to broadcast uses of force by police?
Well, I think we're seeing two trends, one of which is new, one of which is a little older. The older one is the idea that almost everyone is carrying tools with which they can document. And if you think about this, this really goes back to the Rodney King beating and the circumstance of a motorist having a video camera in their car and being able to document that violence. Now that everyone has video cameras on their mobile phones, we've gotten very used to this idea that people can pull out a camera and document. So that's a bit of an older trend. The newer trend is the idea that people can very quickly find an audience for this video. It was very, very interesting that Diamond Reynolds ended up broadcasting the immediate aftermath of the shooting of Philando Castile to Facebook Live. So her Facebook followers and then a much larger group of people were able to watch in real time as she was broadcasting what was going on. And even when the police forced her to throw down her phone and all we could hear was her voice with the phone pointed at the sky, it was extremely powerful documentation of what was, to me at least, quite clearly excessive use of force. So it's not just this ability to document that we're all carrying with us. It's now this new ability for that documentation to find an audience and to find it very quickly.
And in the Alton Sterling case in Baton Rouge, how was that recorded? How did that come to be recorded and disseminated?
Well, it's interesting to think about with Alton Sterling because there appear to be two videos. One is video by a bystander who saw the altercation taking place, pulled out a mobile phone, turned away during the actual shooting, probably fearing for her own safety. But we have a picture of the altercation taking place. We see the context. We hear the shot. There's also video taken by the surveillance cameras in the convenience store. And interestingly enough, the police in Baton Rouge have seized that video, and that has not been released. And because there is still some dispute about whether Sterling was armed or not, there's open questions about when that video will be released. But it's interesting to think about. We now have cameras that we're all carrying in our hands. We have surveillance cameras, often which are backed up to the internet or stored and have some permanency. And we also have police body cams. The police responsible for Castile's death were wearing body cameras. What's interesting is that the body camera alone doesn't necessarily give us an accurate account. They weren't wearing the body cameras correctly. They weren't worn on the person. They were dangling off their bodies, and evidently the footage may not be usable.
And it's interesting because that almost brings it into a difference in witness testimony or witness accounts. What one camera from one angle might capture, what a different camera from a different angle captures, neither one of them is going to be a 360-degree view on what's happening.
One major newspaper did a very interesting demonstration of some of the problems with police body cameras, which is because they are body-worn, because they move as the body moves, they can make things actually look quite different than would be photographed from another perspective. They showed a video shot with body camera that looks like someone assaulting a police officer, and then shot in a wide-angle lens, you see that the person and the police officer are dancing. But the same movements, you know, end up looking very violent when it's held on the body. I think we expect video evidence to be definitive. I think we expect it to answer our questions. In fairness, sometimes it does. If you think back to the case of Walter Scott, that was the motorist who was shot in North Charleston by Michael Slager. And we were lucky enough that Fadine Santana, a Dominican immigrant, happened to be passing by with a mobile phone. He caught footage of Slager shooting Scott as he was running away and then planting a gun on his body. And the North Charleston police responded by firing him and supporting his indictment, and he's now facing trial. But it doesn't always work that way. We remember with Eric Garner in Staten Island, there was video evidence. Many people thought, I thought, that the video evidence was quite ambiguous as far as overuse of force. But a Richmond County grand jury did not indict the officer. In fact, ironically, the only person arrested in the death of Eric Garner was Ramsey Orta, the person who took the footage. Mm-hmm. He became the subject of police scrutiny, and he was arrested on an unrelated weapons charge. And in an ironic moment, he was actually taken to New York State prison today.
And so we're looking at this relatively new dynamic of basically, in any public place, there's going to be someone who has a phone, who has a camera, who can record an event, but not only record an event, now share it in real time or very shortly after. Do you think that this is affecting how the more traditional mainstream media is covering these instances as well?
I absolutely think so. And I think in many ways, the turning point was in Ferguson, Missouri. And after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, we saw an enormous number of people take to Twitter and to Facebook to not only talk about the horror of this death, but to demand that networks like CNN provide coverage to it. In the communication studies world, we call this agenda setting. Who gets to decide what's going to be news? Who gets to decide whether someone's death is newsworthy or not? Social media is now making it possible for groups like the Black Lives Matter movement to say that we're going to pay attention to Philando Castile. In the case of Philando Castile, you had this footage on Facebook circulating, going viral, well before newspapers sort of knew what was going on and knew what to do with it. And that's a very interesting shift. Basically, because Diamond Reynolds was able to get that document out there, there was a much higher chance that people were going to pay attention to this. You know, by contrast, Trayvon Martin, which ended up becoming a massive story, no one really talked about Trayvon's death for about a week after it happened, until the family actually hired a PR agent to try to get people to pay attention to it. Right now, Facebook, social media, is acting as that PR agent.
We're talking with Ethan Zuckerman. He's the director at the Center for Civic Media at MIT, and we are talking about the impact of social media and ready access to technology on these instances of police violence. And Ethan, we talked about how this access and ready access and ready audiences for this kind of coverage is changing the traditional media. How is it impacting public officials and politicians?
Well, I think that the existence of these videos increases the chances that police departments will investigate these matters, and in particular that they'll turn over investigation of these matters to federal authorities, usually the FBI. I think what it does is ensures that these deaths don't happen without notice. My lab is doing a study right now. We're trying to look at media coverage to all deaths of unarmed people of color at the hands of the police from 2014 to 2016. And what we're finding in this is that the vast majority of deaths aren't like Philando Castile or Alton Sterling. We just don't hear about them. They might get two or three stories in local newspapers, but they never become national issues. And when there is no sort of national visibility to a story, there's not as much pressure on local law enforcement, local government to follow up on these things. When these stories become part of the national agenda, when people like you and I are getting on the radio and talking about them, that puts an enormous amount of scrutiny on local police departments and local governments to make some changes and to get things right. So I think this is a way in which activists are using the media well and correctly and using it as a way to get local accountability.
We're talking now about how technology and social media are being used to document police-involved shootings and forceful arrests and how it's impacting the way the public responds.
And we want to hear from you on this. Did you watch citizen videos of forceful arrests or police-involved shootings on social media, from Freddie Gray to Wisconsin's Janelle Lair to Alton Sterling and Philando Castile? Tell us if you think that sharing these videos is impacting things like police accountability. Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think this is making law enforcement stronger? And do you think people are better protected when they're able to record police officers? Call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Ethan Zuckerman, director at the Center for Civic Media at MIT. And we're talking about the recent police-involved shootings of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge and Philando Castile outside of Minneapolis.
And we'd love to hear your take on this. Tell us how you think seeing these videos of forceful arrests or police-involved shootings are impacting your view of the police and the people that they arrest. Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think that there is extra scrutiny on the police now, and is it justified? Call at 800-642-1234. You can let us know if you think officers should be wearing body cameras or if citizens should be allowed to record them. The number 800-642-1234.
And Ethan, do you have statistics? Are there statistics on how many instances of police violence are recorded and shared in any given year?
So amazingly enough, there are no national statistics. This is one of these peculiarities of how law enforcement runs in the United States. Much like our public schools, law enforcement is really on a town-by-town, even a village-by-village basis. And there are not strong reporting requirements that would give us the ability to track so-called officer-involved shootings. People are starting to object to that term because it puts things in the passive voice, situations where police shoot civilians. So the best we have in some ways is a data set that's being put together by the Washington Post and by the Guardian. Each of them are tracking shootings and other killings of civilians at the hands of the police. There's also a data set put together by a number of the Black Lives Matter movement for 2014, looking specifically at unarmed Black people killed by police. So it's very hard for us to look at this and say this has been a particularly bad year or a particularly bad couple of years for police shooting civilians. My sense is that these years are not unusual. And my sense is that what's happening is that we're just now starting to pay attention to a very serious pattern. It's a pattern that has a lot to do with endemic racism. It's a pattern that has to do with militarization of the police. It's a pattern that has to do with U.S. gun culture. It is very, very difficult for law enforcement officers to know that there's a very good chance that the person they are confronting may well be armed. But those three factors, racism, the prevalence of guns, and police training are combining in a really toxic way at this moment in time.
Let's go to the phones, and Frank in Madison is up. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes, I believe that the videos do encourage people to actually stand up and speak out. I just left a community meeting at the Boys and Girls Club on Genuine, and Police Covo was there, the DA Ozami was there, and a couple other UW police chiefs, she was there, and there was a few other police officers, and it actually, the situation in Louisiana and also Minnesota, it has energized a lot of us here in Madison. We're coming on the heels of Janelle Laird, Tony Robinson, and a lot of other people getting beat, killed. And it is frustrating us here in Madison. And a lot of us in the community are just willing to stand up. A new coalition has been formed I am part of that coalition, and we are actually tired. And a lot of it has to do with people filming these incidences. And I truly believe, not a doubt in my mind, that if the case with Janelle Laird wasn't actually videotaped on the phone, I think she would still have to be, she would still be enduring the justice system. And I think it is horrible. It is totally horrible and frustrating me.
Thank you so much for that call, Frank. So Nathan, Frank's saying that these videos can galvanize a community and might actually lead to some safety and accountability as well.
I think that's absolutely right. I think what Frank is talking about is that when people see these videos, they're such powerful imagery. Looking at Diamond Reynolds' video posted yesterday, you can see very, very clearly that she's interacting with amazing restraint, amazing politeness to the officers who have just killed her boyfriend. So you can see just how out of control the police officers are. You can see, by contrast, how she's behaving. And it's very, very hard to watch a video like this and not have a realization that something truly awful is going on. I think that this is helping people who didn't understand just how dangerous and terrifying it can be for people of color to be confronted by police and to be confronted by this level of hostility. People have observed that many people of color have not been shocked by these videos. This is, in fact, something that they've learned to fear and, unfortunately, in some cases, expect. White people, like me, in many cases, are incredibly shocked when we see this and we see what just seems to be behavior that's entirely out of hand. And unfortunately, this behavior happens, and it's behavior that people of color in America are facing every day. So I think it's fantastic that it's turning into mobilization, that it's turning into community action in Madison. And I think it's fantastic that people's response to the situation with Janelle Laird has been to try to ask law enforcement to reconsider their tactics and figure out how to police the community in a more respectful fashion.
So there has also been a response to many of these videos being circulated that seem to show police using excessive force to stand up for police and Blue Lives Matter kind of movement. Where are we seeing that kind of response?
Well, it is really interesting that we have in many cases seen crowdfunding campaigns to pay for the defense of police officers who are accused of murder in these cases. And in many cases, we've actually seen more money raised online for the officers than have been raised for victims' families. And that does suggest that there's a strong group of people who want to point out that it is incredibly difficult to be involved with law enforcement, as I pointed out, in a country that has as serious a problem with guns as ours does. It is a very dangerous and very scary job. But I do think that the law enforcement community in some cases is closing ranks in a way that isn't helpful. You know, when Walter Scott was shot by Michael Slager, it's really hard for anyone to say that Slager behaved appropriately. He shot a man as he was running away and then attempted to plant a gun on his body. It would be really good if we could have a law enforcement community stand up and say, this is unreasonable behavior, we're not going to defend it. And in the case of Philando Castile, I would really like to hear from members of the law enforcement community why this was a reasonable use of force, because from what we're able to see, it really doesn't appear to be so.
Well, Ethan, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. And again, sorry it's on such a sad occasion.
That was Ethan Zuckerman. He's the director at the Center for Civic Media at MIT and an associate professor of the practice in media arts and sciences. He joined us to talk about how technology and social media are impacting public awareness and response to police-involved shootings, particularly of African Americans.